From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we speak to Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley about the ongoing government shutdown.
This has nothing to do with border security. Your shutdown, another Trump-generated crisis, has brought a tsunami of hurt to the American people.
Also today, billions of dollars go into medical marketing. What does that mean for patients and the healthcare profession?
This is marketing that you need to be skeptical and look for independent evidence that these things work. And for patients, that means probably relying on their doctors. And for doctors, that means having access to good information.
And why is it so important for a woman running for president to be likable?
I think it's sexist to assume that every single woman that runs is not likable.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's day 18 of a partial government shutdown with no end in sight. President Trump delivers a primetime address from the Oval Office tonight. He isn't budging from his demand for $5 billion for a border wall. Democrats say they won't fund Trump's signature campaign promise. Meanwhile, more than 800,000 federal workers aren't being paid, and thousands of third-party contractors, like janitors and security guards, may never be paid at all for the time missed. Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley is introducing legislation today that would ensure contractors collect back pay whenever the shutdown finally does end. In fact, she just gave a speech about it on the House floor.
I rise today on behalf of the families concerned about feeding their children because their WIC benefits will run dry. I rise today in solidarity with the thousands of workers with calloused hands and broken spirits working for no pay.
Congresswoman Pressley joins us now from Washington. Congresswoman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's good to be with you.
There is so much to talk about, the shutdown, the president's speech tonight, the legislation you just introduced today. But first, let's just step back for a moment. This is your first full week in Congress. You were just sworn in last Thursday. You spent the morning at a ceremony for the Congressional Black Caucus. Let's listen to a bit of that right now.
Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts.
Must feel good, Congresswoman. And you ran saying the change can't wait. The wait is over for you. So what does it feel like to finally be there in Washington?
I'm ready to get to work. It feels, again, I feel grateful to represent the Massachusetts 7th. I'm proud of what we accomplished in the election to make it possible for me to be here, to work in partnership to effectuate change for the Massachusetts 7th. As I've said repeatedly, I really have not allowed myself much space to be joyful and jubilant because I feel a tremendous sense of responsibility given the time that we find ourselves in as a country, this crossroads, which was true when I was running and is even truer today. So I am glad to be at work and doing the thing that I was most passionate about, and that is legislating. To mitigate the hurt in people's lives and to uplift and to advance the residents of the Massachusetts 7th. And so I'm doing that in the midst of this government shutdown in partnership with the great Eleanor Holmes Norton and also the union members of 32BJ and others, specifically to lift up the fact that although the 800,000 furloughed employees when the government does return to business and the shutdown ends, they will receive retroactive pay. But this is not true for the federally contracted workers, such as the food service workers, janitorial staff, and the like. And so this is an issue of consequence to thousands of workers throughout the country. And Massachusetts 7th is certainly not exempt.
NPR estimated this morning that there are more than 4 million contractors going without pay. So, Congresswoman, are you trying to cover all of them with this bill, or are you particularly targeting the blue-collar workers you were just describing?
I'm focused on the low-wage hourly workers. And so, what I did earlier this week is to send a letter to leadership urging Democratic leadership to make this a part of our negotiations.
So the other big news of the day is this speech the president will deliver from the Oval Office tonight. We can anticipate that he will drum up a lot of anger, as he calls, describes as crisis, as he's called it, on the U.S.-Mexico border. What are the prospects, in your view, Congresswoman, of a compromise between the president's position, he wants that wall, versus Democrats saying, we don't want to give it to you?
No wall. It is unconscionable that a compromise would even be considered that would lead to the construction of such a wall. He has manufactured another crisis, a tsunami of hurt for the American people, and he has couched his rationale in complete falsehoods. Our border is secure. There is no crisis at the border. We are not fearful of families seeking asylum at the border, women and children. What we need is compassionate, comprehensive immigration reform. The immigration crisis is that we don't have compassionate, comprehensive immigration reform. And we have people that are staying beyond their visas because there is no pathway for them. The crisis is not at the border. This is about a larger, more systemic policy change that needs to occur, and a wall will not fix that. So this is a big Trojan horse, and meanwhile, American people are hurting. And as I referenced on the floor in my first one-minute speech, this is everyone from survivors of domestic abuse who are fleeing the hands of their abusers and could stand to show up at shelters and find those doors locked because of this shutdown. This is for families who need WIC benefits to feed their children, and these benefits may very soon run dry. This is for the hourly low-wage worker, food service, janitorial, who has no assurances that even if we come out of a shutdown, that they will be able to pay their bills and to provide for their family. You know, 5 days ago, I took an oath to protect and to defend the Constitution and the American people from all threats, domestic and foreign. And I do believe that the current occupant of the White House is a threat to both of those.
But is there no deal, nothing he could offer that would let you say, you know what, just throw him a bone, just give him his $5 million for the wall? I mean, suppose he were to say, I'd be willing to give you a path to citizenship for dreamers.
I'm not going, let me just say something. I don't make any decision about a vote I will cast or legislation I will author without being in consultation and working cooperatively with those who have been leading on the front lines and who stand to be most impacted by an issue. The families of dreamers have told me, do not negotiate and bargain with the lives of our children.
Let's move on to another.
Because the other issue here is that we could be using $5 billion to fund universal child care. We could be using $5 billion. I mean, here's the real rib here, as ironic as that, he continues to couch this in the fake news narrative of border security when our borders are secure, but he's actually greater compromising our security. Because we need an investment in customs officers, and we need other investments that would get at these broader goals around immigration to stem the scourge of drug trafficking, of human trafficking, of gun trafficking, all of these things. So it would take away resources that would really go a long way in keeping the border secure.
Congresswoman, I do want to ask you about one of your other legislative priorities that you announced shortly after your swearing in, which is your co-sponsoring a legislation to repeal the Pay-As-You-Go Act, or PAYGO for shorthand. This is the law that until this week may have been kind of obscured to a lot of folks, but it's significant in the way the Congress conducts its business. And it basically means that any new spending must be offset by an equal spending cut or a tax increase. Why do you take issue with that principle?
I really do think that this is the strategic solution by getting at the statute that will allow us to address, you know, the underlying issues, which are why I ran.
But is the main problem the policy of it or the politics? Like, is it that PAYGO is just a bad system, or is it that, you know, Democrats would be unilaterally disarming if they were to adhere to the principle, because the Republicans, after all, in 2017, just recently disregarded it when they passed a $1.5 trillion tax cut?
Again, the root of the problem is the policy. It is the law. It is the statute. We need to do away with that so that we are there is no obstruction to our advancing a progressive agenda, especially when we have been emboldened coming in under a Democratic majority. And so many of the majority makers in red to blue states or in more progressive districts ran on everything from a Green New Deal to Medicare for All, and we don't want anything to be an obstruction to these more aspirational goals, which the American people are actually demanding. I saw some chatter on social media earlier today where this proposal and others were being wrapped up in as something radical. But truth be told, these are not fringe pushes. These are not extreme leftist pushes. This is what most Americans want.
You know, one of the other things you ran on, of course, was reducing the impact of big money in politics. In fact, you rejected corporate PAC money in your own race. You've said you plan to lead campaign finance reform efforts in Congress. What exactly are you proposing?
I'm sorry?
Campaign finance reforms. What exactly do you have in mind? Is it a ban on super PACs? What are the particulars?
Well, it's not just me. So I'm very proud that the first a bill that we moved forward as Democrats, H.R. 1, struck right at the heart of two issues that I think are critical to restoring the American people's faith and our democracy, and that is voting rights, campaign finance reform, and ethics reform. And then personally, you know, I will continue to reject corporate PAC money, the influence of dark money. These issues are of consequence to the Massachusetts 7th, the opioid crisis, gun violence, environmental injustices. And for the sake of our planet, for the sake of public health and public safety, I simply cannot accept those funds.
Should all Democrats do the same, including in the 2020 presidential race? Because I'm reminded that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton said that they opposed super PACs, for example, but they also used them. And the argument was basically, you know, you got to play under the rules as they are. Otherwise, you're giving Republicans a huge competitive advantage.
Well, I won't. I'll save my lobbying for outside of this radio interview with any of my colleagues. But I respect, you know, how every one of my colleagues arrives at their own personal choices and decisions. I do think that we're we're all on the same page in terms of legislative fixes to address corruption. We're anti-corruption and undue influence. And I'm proud to be a co-sponsor of H.R. 1 for that reason.
You and your fellow freshmen are also awaiting your committee assignments coming any day now. Is that right?
Yes, anxiously awaiting. And I have been making the rounds and lobbying and hopefully making the case in order to best meet the needs of the Massachusetts 7th and to address the entrenched systemic inequities and disparities that the district will be well served by my appointment to the Financial Services Committee. It would allow me to address not only consumer protection, to keep Ben Carson in my sight line, to address everything from public housing to the affordable housing crisis, but also to address redlining, underbanking, and so many other issues that I think also wealth and the wealth gap, specifically along racial lines. So I hope to be appointed to the Financial Services Committee. With its new chairwoman, Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Hoping to be considered for the Education and Labor Committee, which again are two chief ways to get to systemic inequities and disparities in the Massachusetts 7th. And that would allow me to keep Betsy DeVos in my sight line. And so, you know, I think it would... I think my constituents would be pleased to know that I would wake up with those two priorities every day.
You've also said you'd be interested in serving on the Judiciary Committee, and that's, of course, where impeachment proceedings would begin. You told the Bay State Banner in the fall, quote, "I plan on working actively to see Donald Trump impeached." So what's the status of that effort, and what are the president's impeachable offenses in your view?
Well, let me just say this. You know, first and foremost, impeachment has always been on the table. And what I said is that if I were appointed to judiciary, it would give me a front row seat. I think at this time it's less an issue of if the president will be impeached and perhaps more when. But it's always been on the table. We're waiting the Mueller report. But this is not what I'm leaning in on right now. What we need to do is to get this government out of shutdown, get government working again for the American people, for real people, on those issues that are of consequence to them. This is why, as proud as I am to have supported H.R. 1 and to be a co-sponsor, both to tackle corruption and to strengthen voting rights and all the things critical to restoring the American people's faith in democracy, it also was not lost on me that our closing arguments to the American people were on issues of consequence like health care and infrastructure, issues that every day they are impacted by. And that's why I pushed for an expedited gun bill in my very early conversations with leadership and with the Congressional Progressive Caucus the Democratic Caucus, that we move quickly on a gun bill. And so I'm encouraged to see that happening today. Gun violence is a public health crisis and epidemic. It is certainly an issue that disproportionately impacts the Massachusetts 7th. I'm proud to sign on as an early co-sponsor of that gun bill. I'm looking right now at a letter that I received from the chair of the Gun Violence Prevention Task Force, Congressman Mike Thompson from California, who is the author of that gun bill, which is being dropped today. You know, this is an issue that affects urban communities, rural communities, suburban communities, it is a priority of mine, not only that we address the public health crisis and epidemic that is gun violence, but that we address the trauma, the residual trauma that gun violence leaves in its wake. And so we're taking a big step today with this bill to push for universal background checks, which will go a long way in keeping guns out of the hands of domestic abusers and the mentally ill. Massachusetts has been leading and has very strong laws, but our neighboring states of Maine and New Hampshire have more lax laws. And so when we see violence in the Massachusetts 7th, more often than not, it is being perpetuated by someone with a handgun that came from New Hampshire or Maine. And so we know that we could save lives if we pass a universal background check. But my advocacy and my work won't end there. I want a permanent ban on assault weapons. I want a gun registry. I want us to close the boyfriend loophole. And I want to see federal investment to support survivors, those families who have been impacted by gun violence. I see that as both violence prevention and intervention to support those families. And I plan on broadening the definition of survivor. I think right now most people define it as a survivor of sexual assault or domestic violence, but we need to more broadly define survivor. And the other thing that I would add is Massachusetts has one of the lowest clearance rates in the country, which is insult to injury, that you are robbed of a loved one due to gun violence and then justice is never served. And I look forward to working on that issue specifically with our new district attorney, Rachel Rollins.
Well, it's an ambitious agenda that we know will keep you very busy, so we appreciate you carving out some time for us in your opening days in Congress. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, thanks very much for joining us on Radio Boston.
All right, thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's all too familiar. You're watching your favorite TV show, it goes to a commercial break, and then you see drug ads like these.
If you're struggling with bipolar depression,
if you have moderate to severe rheumatoid arthritis,
if your racing thoughts keep you awake,
maybe you should talk to your doctor about Belsomra, a prescription medicine for adults with insomnia who have trouble falling or staying asleep.
A new study published today in the Journal of the American Medical Association has found that spending on medical marketing skyrocketed from about $18 billion in 1997 to almost $30 billion in 2016. And spending on advertising directly to patients, as in the ads we just heard, rose the fastest. Dr. Stephen Woloshin co-authored the study with his late wife, Dr. Lisa Schwartz. Dr. Woloshin is a professor, physician, and researcher at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, and he joins us now from Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Hello, Dr. Woloshin.
Hi, how are you?
So tell us, if you would, about the key findings of this study that you're just publishing today.
The main finding is what you just said. There's been this enormous growth in marketing of a medicine in the United States. So $30 billion, approximately $30 billion in 2016 is pretty big number. I mean, that's more than the total budget of the National Institutes of Health. It's six times the budget of the FDA, total budget, and they have to regulate food, medicine, and tobacco. So it gives you an idea of the enormous investment that the companies are putting into promoting things. And as you said, the most rapid increase was in direct-to-consumer advertising for prescription drugs and health services. But the biggest amount of money still is advertising to health professionals. So detailing visits, that's where the drug companies send representatives to doctors' offices to ostensibly teach them about drugs, and then free samples, which are given to make them available to patients.
Right, right. So we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, but I want to start with the direct-to-patient advertising that you mentioned off the top, because it was the biggest percentage increase. You found it was about $2 billion in 1997, almost $10 billion in 2016, so about a five-fold increase. What does that tell us about how drug companies are targeting patients, and what concerns do you have about it?
Well, you're right. It tells you that that patients really are the focus, and it makes sense because direct-to-consumer marketing works. There's evidence that it increases patients' requests for drugs and that they get prescriptions for the drugs that they request. And this is for advertised drugs, even if there are lower-cost alternatives available. And it reflects really this general increase in the consumer movement, the idea that we're empowering consumers by presenting them with treatment options. So direct-to-consumer advertising sort of plays into that. And it's important because it bypasses doctors and health systems who might want to practice more conservatively, but the patients now are being encouraged to request these new and more expensive drugs. And it also reflects just general issues that are pushing medical marketing, both professional and consumer, but things that are creating larger and larger reservoir of patients. So scientific advances, which mean that there are more effective treatments. So now once fatal diseases are now chronic illnesses, or an increased interest in prevention, and an aging and more insured population now with Medicare Part D and the Affordable Care Act. And then finally, just the economics of healthcare. There's more and more consolidation and growth of the for-profit sector, and they're competing for patients. So they need to reach these patients, and that's just driving marketing.
I wonder, though, if there can be an upside. And I should point out that there are some important disclosures in these ads as well. So they, as they say, you should talk to your doctor if you're having this symptom or that symptom. They do give you fair warning like this.
Allergic reactions such as shortness of breath or swelling of your tongue or throat may occur and may be fatal.
Patients also reported trouble sleeping and vivid, unusual, or strange dreams.
Other risks include decreases in white blood cells, which can be fatal, dizziness upon standing, seizures, increased cholesterol, weight gain.
If you experience any of these behaviors or reactions, contact your doctor immediately. Wake up ready for your day. Ask your healthcare provider for
So, Dr. Woloshin, I mean, are you satisfied by those disclaimers? And can there actually be an upside to the marketing, which is that maybe we're creating a more informed patient group that doesn't just rely on doctor knows best? Maybe they can ask better questions and advocate for themselves.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. I mean, I don't think that, I mean, to be fair, not all marketing, direct-to-consumer marketing is bad. I mean, there's evidence that it can reduce underuse of treatments, but it also increases overuse of treatments as well. It's a mixed bag. But But I think that you're being a little too generous with the effects of those disclaimers on educating patients. The first thing I'd say is, you know, those statements, they're not quantified. So you don't know how often these things happen. There are these long laundry lists that people tune out. And then I think the most important thing is, how am I supposed to, as a patient, how am I supposed to interpret these things when I don't know how well the drug works? The ads almost never tell you how well the drug works, and people tend to assume that they work really well for everyone. And that's just wrong.
Well, and, you know, we've heard.
And so while it's great that they disclose, sorry?
I was just going to say, you know, we've heard from other physicians as well that, you know, it can be hard when they feel some pressure, you know, when a patient comes in and specifically asks about a certain drug or a certain treatment. You know, just like this summer, we spoke with Dr. Elizabeth Poorman, who's a primary care doctor in Everett. She's also an instructor at Harvard Medical School. And she talked about just that scenario when an affected patient comes in and asks a physician like her, hey, I'm interested in this drug.
In America, medicine is a business, and we haven't really approached, you know, what does that mean for individual physicians? How do you make the right ethical choice for your patient when actually you are a business conduit, right? There are people who are trying to sell these devices, trying to sell drugs, trying to sell surgeries and treatments, who spend all day thinking about how to promote their product, even if the science isn't really there.
Dr. Waloshin, can you relate to that in your own practicing? I mean, do you have patients come to you and say, hey, what about this drug? I saw an ad for it. And how do you deal with that?
Sure. I practiced for many years, and I had many patients come to me. And that's one of the reasons why Lisa and I developed this thing called the Drug Facts Box, which is a way to summarize drug information, the benefits, harms, and uncertainties of a drug using the same information that FDA used when they decided to approve the drug. So the idea is to let people know what FDA knew, so that's information. That's different than a drug ad, which is not talking about benefit, which people assume is there, so it magnifies benefit, side effects in long, unquantified laundry lists, so that minimizes the harms, and doesn't acknowledge uncertainties. So, you know, the drug ads are really effective in the sense that people pay attention to them and maybe they know the names of the drugs. But as far as a vehicle for educating people and promoting informed decision making, I think they're pretty useless.
And to your earlier point, there is also the marketing to physicians. And in fact, there was another study published just a couple of years ago in the Journal of the American Medical Association showed that as little as $20 in free food from a pharmaceutical company could actually influence a physician's prescribing habit. This is the scenario that you were talking about, Dr. Waloshin, where you have maybe a lunch that's ostensibly to inform a doctor about a new treatment therapy. And so I wonder how you handle that and what can the medical profession do about it? Because, as you mentioned, you know, the FDA is stretched thin. There's perhaps not enough people to do the oversight.
Right. I mean, you're raising a really important issue. And I think, it might be interesting to talk about it in the context of the opioid crisis, which, you know, we're also familiar with this tragedy. And that in part that was caused by that sort of marketing. The companies paid thousands and thousands of physicians, pharmacists, and nurses to attend speaker training conferences, and they sponsored more than 20,000 patient education programs. They sponsored these ostensibly scientific organizations like the American Academy of Pain Medicine and the American Pain Society, substantially funded by the opioid manufacturers, but they issued statements endorsing the expanded use of opioids for chronic non-cancer pain and asserted that the addiction risk was low, which wasn't true. And sadly and inexplicably, FDA allowed that kind of language into the label. And the companies also deployed an army of drug reps to go on the detailing visits to meet with doctors in their offices to promote opioid prescribing. The detailing visits accounted for one of the biggest categories of marketing, over $5 billion in 2016. So FDA can monitor the print and television ads, but they have no way to monitor what goes on in these encounters or the drug company dinners or the training programs to push their agenda. And that's a recipe for disaster. In the case of the opioid crisis, prescriptions and sales quadrupled between 2000 and 2015, and so did deaths.
Dr. Waloshin, you co-authored this study with your late wife, Dr. Lisa Schwartz. She passed away from cancer in November. Please accept our condolences. I know that you worked on a lot of things together, from lobbying the FDA for the drug fact box that you talked about. And I just wonder how you're feeling now that the study has been published, knowing this was such a big collaboration for the two of you.
Yeah, well, we worked on this paper for almost 2 years, and I'm very proud of the work that we did, and it's very bittersweet because I'm also it's extremely sad and hard for me to even talk about it because the loss is so devastating. You know, everything I know about these issues that we've been talking about, I learned with her or from her, the only reason I'm here today is really because she believes so strongly that medicine was being corrupted by marketing, and she wanted to do what she could to help people make good decisions and get them the information they need that hasn't been influenced by people trying to sell something. So I'm really proud of the work. I'm really happy that the journal published this beautiful tribute to her. It means a lot to me. But, I'm just devastated.
An important legacy, and we appreciate your sharing it with us. Dr. Woloshin is a professor, physician, and researcher at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. Thanks for being with us, and thanks for bearing with a slight delay on your line as well.
Sure. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Coming up, why is it so important for a woman running for president to be likable? I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. When Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren formed her presidential exploratory committee, and even before that, criticism rolled in. She's too progressive, too divisive. She botched that DNA test. But much of the scrutiny centers on one theme: likability. Hillary Clinton knows something about that. In fact, she cracked jokes about it at an event at the New York State Capitol just yesterday.
You know, there's been a lot of talk recently about whether our country is ready for women leaders. Now, that really takes me back. But today, I want to thank all of you for your persistence. I know many of you and can attest as to how smart, determined, effective, and dare I say, likable you all are.
But why does a woman have to be likable in politics in the first place? Well, here to chat about all of that is Ellen Fitzpatrick. She's a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Hello, Ellen. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Also with us from the Boston Globe is Janae Osterholt. She's a cultural writer for the Globe. Hello, Janae.
Hi, thank you.
And listeners, we'd like to hear from you on this as well. Should likability matter in politics? Are women punished in politics and in culture for not being likable enough? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, Ellen, what do you make of these concerns about whether Elizabeth Warren is likable enough? Should that matter?
Well, I think the likability of any candidate obviously is a variable. Voters need to feel comfortable with whomever they choose as their candidate, and it's perfectly legitimate to have that be a variable in the decisions that a voter makes. The question is, how is one's likability determined or framed? And I think in contemporary presidential politics, so much of it is driven by media, that the candidate themselves don't always have an easy time of establishing their likability before it's determined for them.
Well, part of Warren's effort to establish herself as likable may have been a live stream on New Year's Eve that's attracted a lot of attention. We'll play a little bit of it. This is Warren drinking a beer in her home, and the video was seen by some as inauthentic, perhaps pandering. Take a listen.
Hold on a sec. I'm going to get me a beer. Hey, Robert, my husband Bruce is now in here. You want a beer?
So, Janae, you wrote about this. You wrote that perhaps our need to define a woman by how cool or nice or pleasant they are is why Warren felt the need to chug a beer on Instagram in the first place. So what do you think was going on there? What are the dynamics at play?
It's just I agree that likability is important, but only if we're playing by the same definitions, which is, you know, if we're talking about political candidate, that's diplomacy and working well with others. But I feel like as applied to women, it's about coolness and niceness, and if their voice is a certain tone, or if how they hold their face. And with that, with her chugging a beer, even she said it was like a way to invite people into her home, an everyday person. And I think there was this attempt to like humanize her, which is crazy because she's already a human. She's already she doesn't need to do that. And but it's like we have made it this way. Like, how can she be more likable? You know, there's people who don't like her voice, they don't like her face, they don't like her clothes. None of that has anything to do with diplomacy or her skills or her talent. There's plenty of things we can talk about legitimately as far as her capabilities, but this whole idea of is she the girl you want to hang out with is ridiculous, and it's only something that I see happening to women.
So the standards of likability can be different. The things that some people like about their candidates will be turnoffs for others, obviously. You know, for example, Elizabeth Warren has really sort of leaned into some of this. She's been able to fundraise off of and create some merchandise around that nevertheless she persisted remark from Senator Mitch McConnell last year. So that's one way to answer it. And yet I get the sense, Ellen, that it's more of a drag. You know, while you may be able to fundraise some money off of this and make it kind of a rallying cry, that on the whole, this kind of scrutiny of a candidate's likability is more problematic than help.
Well, I think the problem is that our standards of what is likable, or the sort of prevailing conversation about that, has been largely determined by male candidates. So that if the standard is this somebody who you want to go out and have a beer with, as opposed to a glass of white wine, let's say, it's a hard test, I think, for most women to come across as likable in that way. It was said about George W. Bush that he was a likable guy. Maybe he didn't like his politics, but he came across as, you know, sort of down to earth, and that appealed to some voters. And so the difficulty is when the gender question gets into the mix, as it will whenever there's a woman presidential candidate, how is likability determined, and how do the candidates try to play to that?
You know, the Bush example is a good one, because just yesterday we saw Joy Behar on The View suggesting that perhaps Warren was making a joke and making a reference to that, you know, George W. Bush, he's the guy you want to have a beer with thing, and maybe that's what she was trying to get at.
Right.
You know, was sort of poke fun at this standard. That's,
I wish I thought it was sardonic, but unfortunately, it seems as if it wasn't.
All right. So, listeners, once again, you can chime into this conversation as well. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And Lizzie is calling in from Lexington. Lizzie, what's on your mind? Nope, we don't have Lizzie now. I'm sorry. So I'm going to go back to Janae. My question to you, Janae, right now is how this sort of expands beyond politics as well, because you write not only about the context of Elizabeth Warren, but also a recent episode involving the comedian Tiffany Haddish. Remind us what was going on with her around New Year's weekend as well.
Tiffany Haddish failed. She just flopped. She had comedians, all famous comedians have done it, from Richard Pryor to Dave Chappelle. I mean, she had a bad night, and even in the middle of it, she told the crowd, like, I'm failing. This is going to be on TMZ. This is terrible. Like, she knew what was happening. It was just all coming apart. She wasn't prepared. She took accountability. She apologized. It happened. I'm not, like, obviously the audience had every right to be disappointed and want their money back even. But that's not where the conversation went. The dialogue went into this very big viral moment of heckling Tiffany Haddish and kind of delighting in her failure and just, you know, I didn't like her anyways and I don't like her and she's too quote unquote loud and ghetto, and things that I don't really feel like have anything to do with a comedian. Like, comedians don't necessarily have to be likable. They have to be funny. But there's a difference between funny and likable. I mean, most comedians, I hate to, no offense to comedians, but they're not exactly like, you know, likable people. Like, they make fun of everything. So it's sort of interesting to me that in the case of Tiffany Haddish, it was this, you know, 2.5 million people viewing, over 11,000 likes, literally enjoying her getting heckled and failing, talking about how much they don't like her.
Right. And, so the viral moment was really accelerated by one video in particular. So if you've missed it somehow, we'll play a little bit of it. This is a man who was in the audience heckling Tiffany Haddish during the performance.
Tiff having a rough night, bro. Tiff having a rough night, bro. Going into 2019 like this.
So, Janae, I think what's so uncomfortable about that is this just joy he seems to take in. He's just reveling in her struggle on stage there.
Yeah, there's a real delight. There's a real delight in the fact that it's happening. And like I said, the response online went viral and people joined in. You know, they don't like her. And it's just a really interesting thing. And it made me think about the fact, why might you not like Tiffany Haddish? So many of them kept saying, quote unquote, she's quote unquote loud and ghetto, which is just problematic in itself. But the idea is Tiffany Haddish is succeeding. She may have failed that night, but she's having the time of her life and her career. And we've seen time and time again when women succeed, you know, when they succeed, it is correlated to not being likable. Like, there's a study that came out in Ohio at Ohio State University that showed women who do really well, who have high GPAs, are less likely to get contacted by employers than males who have those same high GPAs, because a woman with a high GPA is perceived as not likable. So they'd rather a woman who, you know, does okay.
Well, and you wrote about the fact, I mean, Haddish did bomb in the performance, but perhaps the standard is different. And you mentioned that Dave Chappelle had a similarly bad performance, that
he had a lot more
grace, right?
So much more grace, and people kind of laughed along. It became sort of a joke. It's something he even joked about later when he staged his huge comeback and critically acclaimed Netflix specials. It was kind of like a ha-ha, this thing happened in Detroit. And he went back recently and had a great show there. And it's just, there's a grace allowed to men when they make mistakes versus women who, even though he didn't really take accountability. He was just like, yeah, I did it. You're not getting your money back. Ha-ha. You know, I feel like she took accountability and it was just no grace. And even if she hadn't, it would have been worse. It's like there's no win for a woman when she makes a mistake. It's just everything is inflated and it goes right to, why I didn't like you anyways.
All right, I want to try again to bring in Lizzie from Lexington. Lizzie is on the line. What's on your mind, Lizzie?
I think this is an interesting conversation, and I'm happy to be a part of it. But my goal for 2019, as I try to support other women candidates, is to amplify their political message, their talking points, the things that I've heard them say in interviews, their policy points, and get that out there, as well as bringing up the niceness or the likability or the affability when we have this conversation.
Thanks for the call, Lizzie. So, Ellen, to you off of that point, here's someone who's sort of almost making a New Year's resolution, you know, to maybe think about this a little bit differently. I'm curious about how the press should perhaps think about it in 2019. You know, we are already at the start of the 2020 presidential cycle, believe it or not, because Warren was just in Iowa. What are your thoughts on how press coverage plays into this?
Well, I think that, you know, we're living in a moment where it appears that the American presidency is becoming a reality television show, and that presidential politics and national politics itself are covered so extensively and in such subjective ways by cable news that it's a form of entertainment, infotainment, which I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, the latter, and if it engages voters. But I think what the press can do is to interrogate some of these very questions about how our perceptions of candidates are shaped, and to try to shift the conversation, as your caller suggested, to more substantive matters. And perhaps the Trump presidency will be a corrective on this point. There'll be other women candidates involved as well in this race, it appears. And so the likability question of one versus another may, in this instance, contribute to a broader discussion as well. So I think it's important for the press to be self-conscious and to try to peel back some of these layers, have conversations like this one and others, really looking at the way that voter perceptions are shaped by these two-minute sound bites, by social media, and by fairly superficial responses based on how someone comes across on television.
A recent article in The Atlantic suggested the problem is not discussing likability per se, but doing it without that context, without discussing what may be behind why someone doesn't like a particular candidate, that sexism can play a part of it. And we've seen examples of this, sort of bringing it up absent that context. I'm thinking back to a memorable presidential debate exchange in 2008. This was during the Democratic primary between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama at a debate in New Hampshire. And one of the moderators, Scott Spradling, who was the Channel 9 WMUR anchor, asked this question to Hillary Clinton.
My question to you is simply this. What can you say to the voters of New Hampshire on this stage tonight who see your resume and like it, but are hesitating on the likability issue, where they seem to like Barack Obama more?
Well, that hurts my feelings.
I'm sorry, Senator. I'm sorry.
But I'll try to go on. He's very likable. I agree with that. I don't think I'm that bad.
You're likable enough.
Thank
Hillary,
you so much.
So, Ellen, you know, it was that likable enough quip from Barack Obama that caught a lot of attention at the time. But I'm struck listening to that now more than a decade later at the way the moderator's question lacked that framework to say perhaps the likability gap here is colored by sexism.
Well, I think it was an extremely insulting and insensitive question. And I think that Obama's comment was very condescending. And as I listen to it, I'm struck by how honest she was in her response and how human she was in saying. I mean, if somebody looks you right in the face and says, how come nobody likes you? I mean, what human being isn't going to feel badly about that? So she responded, I thought, in a human fashion to that. But, you know, one would hope that we would be in a political climate in which these would not be the focal points of the discussion. There's so many serious problems in our country today and around the world. We really need answers from our political leaders. And the press should be asking questions that are substantive of these candidates and helping the voters to really focus on what matters.
Let's bring in another caller. Jen is phoning in from Worcester. Jen, how do you see likability show up in your profession?
Well, I'm calling. So I just graduated from law school in May, and so I'm a very new attorney. And I just wanted to comment about how this adds, like, one more problem to the plate of professional women's worries, who we already have so much more mental work. Like, you know, am I wearing too much makeup? Not enough makeup? Is it unprofessional? Are my heels too high to be professional? Are they not high enough, like, that I don't look fancy enough? Or all of this. And now when I hear this discussion, I just wanted to speak to how deeply it affects young women who are developing in this climate and hearing, like, having one more burden put onto our plate that I don't hear being added to men. So thank you for taking my call.
Jen, thanks for the call. Let's go to one more. Caleb in Londonderry. Caleb, we just heard Jen say she doesn't see this likability standard applied to men. What do you see?
Well, I wanted to bring up that I've seen likability. I'm a history teacher, and I bring up charisma and likability in candidates throughout the whole course. For instance, Bill Clinton, when he went on Arsenio Hall and played the saxophone, he was presenting himself as the everyday man. Al Gore, which came across as stoic and boring, loved Bush, the everyday, everyman president, you know, the buddy you can have a beer with, like you were saying earlier. And I think your commentator was correct that it is how we frame things, but it's also been going on for male candidates over a long time as well.
Caleb, thanks for the call. So, Janae, in the moments that we have left, what about that argument from Caleb? You know, that it cuts both ways. You know, likability is a factor for men, too.
I would argue that men get way more grace, and when men get way more cool points, whereas women, like in the case of Warren with the beer, it was a penalty point. It wasn't like, oh, she's cool, let's have a beer with her. Look at her. She's just at home with her husband and her dog. It was like, penalty point, you're trying. So whereas, you know, Clinton playing the sax was cool. Clinton going on MTV was cool. But if she strolls out to MTV next, it'll be an issue. It'll be like, oh, you are trying so hard to be the cool girl. And there are penalty points issued for women. And these are things that, like, the caller said, professional women deal with this in their offices all the time. A man might be called confident for having a new idea. He will be called innovative and bold for disagreeing with someone. A woman will be called bossy and shrew and emotional. And these are the ways in which we have to think about how things are getting framed and how things are very gendered and how it's absolutely not the same for men.
And we've got almost 2 years to keep having the conversation as we head toward the 2020 election. Janae Osterholt is the culture writer for the Boston Globe. Her latest piece is There's Inequity in How We View Men, Women, and Likeability. Janae, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And our thanks also to Ellen Fitzpatrick. She's a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Ellen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.